Side 8, Eon by Greg Bear, continuing on page 301. I'm receiving a judgment, said the advocate, still flying the American flag on her shoulder. She approached the group with hands extended. She has an implant. They all do, Patricia explained to Lanier, touching her head. She's listening to the court decision now. The case is cleared from all pre-trial court records and negated by circumstance, the woman announced. You are all guests of the Axis Nader. With a meaningful glance at Olney, Ram Kikura added, by authority of the presiding minister. Chapter 43. Vyogorsky stood in front of the black panel which marked the entrance of the third chamber library. Across the plaza, almost shadowless in the tube light, Bilizersky and Yazykov walked cautiously toward him. Behind them followed two squads of SSTs, their rifles unslung. Mirsky and Pogodin watched from the abandoned NATO security post, a small room in the overhang equipped with a video monitor. Mirsky toyed with the loud hailer switches. Pogodin looked at him. We're taking a chance now, he said. I know. Pogodin turned back to the screen. Mirsky aimed the American listening device at them and increased the volume. We won't need more soldiers, Vyogorsky said. I have already sent Mirsky and Pogodin to the fourth chamber for detention. He seems to be cooperating, Pogodin said quietly. Mirsky nodded. There was indeed a risk here. It had become apparent to him in the past couple of days that without Vyogorsky he could not rule. He had neither the experience nor the inclination to engage in political intrigue and survive for long. Vyogorsky was the best of the political officers. If he and Mirsky could not work together, then no cooperation was possible. Mirsky doubted that he could kill all of them, which was the alternative. It would be better for him to turn himself over to the Americans or become lost in the cities and fend for himself. I think it is time you see what we fought for and learn how to use it, Vyogorsky said. I have no desire to imitate Mirsky, Bilizersky said. I do not care for that place. Comrade, Vyogorsky said patiently, knowledge is power. Do you want to be more ignorant than the rest? I have been in there, and I am still Vyogorsky, still party secretary. Yes, Yazykov said. It doesn't frighten me. Nor I, Bilizersky said hastily. But then let's enter and see what Mirsky was up to, spending so much time here. Mirsky trained the video cameras on them until they passed out of view. There was something else at stake. Was it possible to be ignorant of the character of one's own country, after having spent one's entire life within its borders? Yes, there was no basis for comparison, and however much he knew, without comparison the knowledge was dormant. Even with the library's information, he had to conduct an experiment. However unfair the test was, he would now judge his country and all it stood for by how Vyogorsky acted. You'll take their weapons, Mirsky said. We can't have them armed when I appear. You're going down there now? Pogodin asked. Yes. You trust Vyogorsky that much? I don't know. It's a risk. Not just for you, Pogodin said. We cooperated with you. Pletnyov, the scientists, myself, Anyinkovsky, Garabedian. Mirsky headed for the stairwell. His back crawled as he descended the stairs. He was more afraid now than when he had leaped from the heavy lifter in the borehole. Strangely, he felt like a child again, and he was tired. He had observed the same weariness in the American, Lanier. Opening the door, stepping out onto library floor, only the three Zampolites had entered. Vyogorsky, holding a pistol on Bilizersky, Yazykov standing to one side, staring at his fellow political officer in dismay. Their rifles lay scattered on the floor, kicked out of reach. Come forward, Comrade General, Vyogorsky said. He took several steps to one side, still pointing the pistol, and bent to pick up an AKV. Bilizersky stared at Mirsky with uncomprehending hatred. Yazykov's face was blank, tightly controlled. Mirsky walked across the plaza toward them. When he was 5 meters from the group, Vyogorsky turned the pistol away from Bilizersky, lifted it, and sighted along the barrel at Mirsky. I do not thank you, comrade, he said. He squeezed the trigger. Mirsky's view of things skewed, as if the anamorphic lens on a motion picture projector were suddenly twisted. One side of his head seemed very large. He fell on his knees and leaned forward, bowed, then fell over, his cheek smacking sharply against the yielding floor. That hurt more than whatever had happened to his head. His one good eye blinked. Vyelgorsky lowered the pistol, handed it to Bilizersky, walked toward the scattered rifles, picked up and aimed an AKV at the chairs and globes on the plaza, and began firing a clip. Teardrops shattered and bullets ricocheted, the sound somewhat distant and unimpressive in the large hall, even with the echoes. Bilizersky's yell of triumph and delight was cut short by a very big sound, impossible to describe. The three political officers twitched. Vyelgorsky dropped his weapon and jerked his head back. Yazykov clapped his hands to his ears and mouth. All three collapsed. White streamers jetted from the ceiling all around the plaza and untwisted into thick fog. The fog lay down over them, and Mirsky closed his eye, grateful at last for the undisturbed slumber. Chapter 44 Lanier, lying on the couch, hand-gripping the African print upholstery, staring up at the featureless cream-colored ceiling, ostensibly resting, knew this much and very little more. Their quarters were located in the outer reaches of the rotating cylindrical precinct called Axis Nader. 5 apartments along a hallway, each with a bedroom, a bathroom, and a living room. At the end of the hallway, a communal dining area and a large circular lounge. The centrifugal force at this level of the precinct was just slightly less than that at the Stone's chamber floors. All the quarters were closed off and lacked real windows, though illusart windows of idyllic terrestrial scenes in the apartments and lounge provided a sensation of spaciousness which was hard to deny. Someone had gone to considerable effort to make the accommodations pleasant and familiar. What Lanier gathered, from all the fuss, was that they were important people. Whether they were prisoners or honored guests, it was impossible to tell for the time being. He turned his head to one side, reached over to a stack of magazines on the coffee table near the couch, picked up a copy of Stern and flipped through it, not really looking at the turning pages. His eyes kept tracking the apartment, lingering on little details. The art glass vase in one corner of a bureau, red and purple with overlaid gold threads, the rich-feeling couch fabric, the books that lined one shelf, and the memory cubes stacked in an ebony wood holder nearby. He was about to put the magazines down on a frosted glass coffee table when he realized he hadn't looked at the issue's date, March 4th, 2004, over a year old. Where did they find it? Or any of the objects in the apartments? "May I come in?" Patricia asked. The apartment door became transparent, and he saw her standing in the hallway. Judging by her attitude, she could not see in. "Yes," he said, "please do." She continued standing outside. "Gary, are you home?" He puzzled this over for a moment. She hadn't heard him. Symbols appeared in the air to one side of the door, flickering rapidly, little marvels of calligraphy. Picks, Patricia had called them, statements made up of single symbols called icons. When nothing happened, he approached the door, and the room voice, sexless and melodic, asked, "You have a visitor, Mr. Lanier. Would you like Patricia Luisa Vasquez to enter?" "Yes, please, let her in," he said. The door became opaque again, and then slid aside. "Hello," she said. "We're all meeting in a half hour, getting together with the woman who was in the hangar. Omi says she's our advocate. I thought I'd talk things over with you first." "Good idea," he said. "Let's sit." He took a comfortable leather-upholstered chair, and Patricia sat on the couch. She folded her hands in her lap and regarded him steadily, her lips pursed as if to hold back a smile. "What in hell happened to you?" Lanier asked. "Isn't it obvious? I was kidnapped. I think we were being invaded or something. I was half crazy then, maybe more than half. So I took a train to the third chamber, and Olmi found me there. He had a frant with him, a non-human." "Who is Olmi?" "You met him, the one who took us here and arranged for the quarters to be done in period. Yes, I met him, but who is he? What rank? What importance? He's an agent of some sort. He does work for the Nexus, the main governing body of the Hexamon. He's been my teacher for the past few days, ever since we got here. Were we being invaded? Yes, Linnea said, by Russians. He told her what had happened, and she listened intently. I think that's one reason Olney wanted me out of the chambers, she said. He thought I might be in danger. I'm not yet sure why he chose me in particular, but... She shrugged. I have some ideas. They've already put me through tests. They'll test you, too. Diagnostics, psychological, everything. All in a few minutes. It doesn't hurt. They're really interested in our bodies. We're historical curiosities. I'll bet. At any rate, when I heard you had been kidnapped, I went a bit crazy myself. Judith Hoffman made it up to the stone from Station 16. How wonderful, Patricia said. Was anybody with her? Yes, nobody we knew. Patricia's expression of joy stiffened. She obviously decided I wasn't going to be very effective anymore. You were the last straw, I think.
Me?
Hoffman told me to take care of you. I couldn't prevent what happened on Earth, and I lost you besides. I don't take failure very well, Patricia. He rubbed his cheeks and eyes. Failure. Yes, I suppose you could call losing the whole Earth failure. Patricia gripped her hands tightly between her knees.
Not lost, she murmured.
So Hoffman authorized an expedition to find you.
It's good to have you all here, my friends, my helpers.
Her sudden cheeriness had an edge. We're really guests here, then, he asked.
Oh, yes. They weren't expecting you, though when Olney first heard, he knew it had to be the tube rider. They consulted him right away, since he had been down the corridor most recently.
Do they know about the stone? What we've been doing?
Yes, I suppose they do. Olney must have told them.
And do they plan to do anything with us? I mean, I assume they're still interested in the stone.
I'm not sure. Some of them are. It's confusing, and I've only been taking lessons steadily for the last couple of days. It's all very political. That's what Olney tells me.
They're advanced, aren't they? Linnea asked.
Oh, yes. But not so much we can't understand a lot of things. Our rooms, for example, they're not very different from that apartment in the third chamber, the one Takahashi showed me.
Linnea hadn't mentioned Takahashi's treason. He didn't think it necessary now.
All the decorations are illusions, Patricia said. There's a picture, a kind of projector, in each room. It makes our minds feel and see the elaborations. The furniture is here in basic shape and function, but everything else is projected. They've had this technology for a long time, centuries. They're as used to it as we are to electricity.
Linnea reached out and riffled the copy of Stern, then pulled a copy of Time from beneath it. These magazines, that vase, he pointed to the art glass, are just records stored somewhere, projected?
I suppose they must be.
Are they watching us now?
No. They told me they aren't, anyway. Privacy is very important here.
You said you had an idea why they wanted you.
Well, just a guess. Olney might have been worried I would find a way to change the sixth chamber machinery.
But he wanted to keep you safe.
Out of trouble.
She stood and nodded at the decorations.
Do you like what they've done?
It's thorough. He shrugged. It's comfortable.
They're good at matching decor to people. My rooms are comfortable, too. Not very much like home, though. I'm...
The edge in her cheerfulness became fully visible for an instant, making her eyes hard and determined.
I'm not taking everything well. Some parts of me are pretty messed over.
That's not unexpected, Linnea said.
They're going to help, she said. They're going to help me find home. They can, you know. They don't know it yet, but they will. I've learned that much since I've been here. The corridor is very twisty.
She tangled her fingers and tugged her arms against them.
Let's go join the others.
Olney stood in the center of the circular lounge, Suliram Kikura beside him. He introduced her to each of the five, formally and at length, telling her the functions they had served on the Thistledown. Lanier was impressed by how much Olney knew. He seemed to have kept a dossier on all of them. "And this is Sir Suliram Kikura, your advocate. Your arrival on the tube rider was highly illegal, so she's been of service to you already. She had your court case negated because of the circumstances. And under authority from the presiding minister," she added. "It's not something an advocate of my standing could have accomplished on her own." "She may underestimate herself," Olney said. "Now that we know each other's names, I think we'd better get everything out in the open," Ram Kikura said. Olney took a seat and folded his arms. "First of all, most of the citizens and clients of the Axis City and the communities along the way, what you call the corridor, talk to each other by picting." She touched the torque around her neck and looked at Heinemann. Flashes of light darted before his eyes. "I'm wearing a personal pictor. You will all be given pictors in a couple of days. It won't be absolutely necessary for you to learn the graphic speech, but it will be very helpful. Lessons should take no more than 2 or 3 days. Miss Vasquez, I understand, already has a rudimentary knowledge of Picts." "Amenities," Patricia said. "I speak American English and have for years because I am proud of my ancestry, which is North American, specifically United States of America, even more specifically, California. When you first saw me, you might have noticed I was picting a flag from the USA over my left shoulder. This is frequently done by Amerophiles. It symbolizes our pride. After the death, it was considered shameful to claim either Russian or American heritage. Those who did so were persecuted. Americans were persecuted more than Russians. When South Americans and Mexicans repopulated large sections of North America, people claiming to be citizens of the United States were arrested. The Naderites of that time were trying to create a unified world government, and there was resentment against the former superpowers." "That's changed?" Heinemann asked. Ram Kikura nodded. "The United States gave us most of our culture, the foundations of our laws and government. We feel about America as you might feel about Rome or Greece. Citizens take considerable pride in having American ancestors. If your presence becomes generally known..." Lanier clenched one hand tightly, worried by the implications of indefinite secrecy. "Then I will have to act as your theatrical agent, I'm afraid." Her smile seemed to indicate both humor and confidence. Lanier released some of the tension in his fist. Farley shook her head.
"I'm Chinese. Do I miss out?"
Ram Kikura smiled.
"Not in the least. Those with Chinese heritage make up at least a third of the hexamon, far more than Americans. As for your status, for the time being, your presence here is being treated as a hexamon secret. You will not have any further contact with citizens of the hexamon until that situation changes. Nevertheless, you have all the rights accorded to hexamon guests. Not even the president himself could take those rights from you. One of them is the right to have an advocate represent your interests and advise you. Should anyone here object to my being your advocate, let me know immediately, and another will be assigned." She looked from face to face. There were no objections. She hadn't expected any. "Your status here is that of potential client innocence. That is, you may be of service to the hexamon, and such services will gain you advantages, what you might term payment. But for the moment, you are not to be disturbed. As innocents, you will be studied, unless you object, and the knowledge gained from these studies will be invested for you in certain hexamon information banks. It will also be available to the Nexus and other governing bodies of the hexamon, whether you object or not."
"I have some questions," Lanier said.
"Please ask them."
"What's the hexamon and the Nexus?"
"The hexamon is the totality of human citizens. You might call it the state. The Nexus is the main lawmaking body of this city, and of the way from the Thistledown and the Forbidden Territory to Mark 2X9, that is, the 2 billion kilometer point of the way.
You're all descended from the Stoners, the people who lived in the Thistledown?" Carolson asked.
"Yes," Ram Kikura said.
"Excuse me," Heinemann said. "How many people live here? How large is this Axis City?" Ram Kikura smiled and picked at instructions to the empty walls. There were no data pillars anywhere. Apparently their functions had been integrated into the inconspicuous room pictures. A very solid-looking image of the Axis City appeared next to her, rotating slowly. Heinemann leaned forward in his seat, frowning in concentration. 100 million humans occupy the city and the way. 10 million live off-city, along the way, chiefly traders and coordinators of the 571 active wells. 90 million live in the Axis city. Of these, 70 million are in city memory. Most of those have lived out their legal 2 incarnations and have retired their bodies to exist as personality patterns in the city memory environment. Under special circumstances, they may be assigned new bodies, but most often they are content in memory. Some 5 million deviant personalities, those who are incomplete or deranged in such a way they cannot be redeemed, even with extreme methods of therapy, are kept inactive. "People don't die?" Carolson asked. "Death and dying here usually refer to loss of corporeal states, not mental states. In a word, no, or very rarely," Ram Kikura said. "All of us are equipped with implants." She touched a spot behind her ear, then moved her finger to a spot above the bridge of her nose. "They supplement our reasoning, and should an accident occur, they retain a record of our most recent experiences and personality. The implant is almost indestructible. It is the first thing we recover from the victim of an accident. Every few days, we update our backups in city memory with records from these implants. That way, a personality can be quickly reconstructed. All we need to do is make a final update and inhabit a new body, and the resurrection is indistinguishable from the original." She looked around the room, ready to field more questions. There were none. Implications were beginning to sink in. "I'll use Olmi as an example," Ram Kikura said.
"With his permission?"
Olmi nodded.
"He is something of a rarity because of his age and history. His original body was born 5 centuries ago. His first death was by accident. The destruction was not total, so he was reconstructed. Since he was considered important to the Hexamon and was involved in dangerous work, he was allowed 3 incarnations rather than the usual 2. His present body is adapted for specialty work. It's a popular type and is completely self-contained. His waste systems are also closed. Within his abdomen there is a small power supply. All his wastes are reprocessed internally. He needs to replace his power source and bring in supplementary materials only once a year. He requires water every 3 months.
"Are you human?" Carolson asked Olmi pointedly.
"I am," Olmi said. "I presume you're curious about my sexuality."
"What?"
"Yes, frankly," Carolson admitted. Heinemann squinted one eye and raised the opposite brow. "I am fully masculine by birth and choice, and my sexual organs are functional."
"They are indeed," Ram Kikura said.
"But natal sexual orientation, even in those born naturally, is not necessarily permanent."
"You mean once a man, not always a man?" Farley asked.
"Or a woman, or man or woman. Many neomorphs today have no specific sexual orientation."
"You talk about those born naturally," Heinemann said. "You have test tube babies, that sort of thing?"
"At the risk of shocking you, which may be unavoidable, most people today are not born of man and woman. Their personalities are created by one or more parents through the merging of partial personalities in city memory, with the infusion of what we call mystery from at least one individual, usually a parent. The young personality is educated and tested in city memory, and if it passes certain tests, it matures, that is, it earns its first incarnation, most often as a mature young adult. The corpus the personality inhabits may be designed by the parents or by the individual. If in time the corporeal citizen uses its 2 incarnations, it then retires to city memory."
Carolson started to say something, thought better of it, then decided to speak anyway.
"Are the people without bodies, in the computers, are they human? Are they alive?" she asked.
"They believe so," Ram Kikura said. "They have specific rights and certain duties as well, though by necessity their say in government is less than that of corporeal citizens. But if I may suggest, we are not discussing the subjects of most immediate importance."
She pointed toward the rotating image of the city.
"This is where you will stay. For the time being, you cannot return to the Thistledown. Your home will be in this precinct, Axis Nader, where conditions are reasonably familiar. Design, culture, people. Though you may not meet them for some time, this precinct is inhabited by Orthodox Naderites. Miss Vasquez has told Ser Olmi that some of you are aware of the basics of our history.
then you will understand that Orthodox Naderites typically prefer conditions as close to those of Earth as possible. This section contains many areas of natural beauty and as few illusions in the public thoroughfares as possible. There are two other rotating precincts, Axis Thoreau and Axis Euclid, spaced beyond the central city. Axis Thoreau is also occupied by Naderites, though of a more liberal persuasion. More questions, Lanier said. When can we return to our people?
I don't know. That decision isn't ours to make.
Can we send a message to them?
No, Olme said. Technically, your people are in violation.
Isn't the situation a little unusual, Lanier asked, now that the Thistledown has returned to Earth? Olme looked distinctly uncomfortable.
Unusual and very complicated.
Patricia touched Lanier's hand and gave a slight shake of her head. Enough for now.
After you've eaten, you will have time to become reacquainted and learn how to use your accommodations. Then you may rest. Tomorrow morning you will be awakened in your rooms. Please return here.
In the hallway, Patricia walked close to Lanier.
We're pawns, she said in an undertone. We've set off alarms.
She held her finger to her lips and darted into her doorway. Chapter 45 Wu and Zhang walked arm in arm from the train station to the library plaza, saying little but obviously content with each other's company. They had decided hours before to go to the library together to make the pilgrimage that so many were planning, but few had time to actually do. Singly and in groups, perhaps a total of 20 members of the NATO and Allied forces and the science teams had gone and had returned with awed reports of the library's potential. This impressed Wu. He had asked permission of Hua Ling, and since their studies had been reduced in scope, the leader of the Chinese team had agreed. But something was wrong. Russian soldiers milled outside the library in some confusion. As they spotted Wu and Zhang crossing the plaza alone, they dropped prone on the pavement and raised their rifles. Wu held up his hands instinctively. Zhang backed away a step and seemed ready to run.
No, my love, Wu whispered.
What are they doing?
I don't know. I recommend we make no fast moves.
She edged up beside him and raised her hands high as well, glancing at him for approval. He nodded. They maintained this position for several long and unpleasant minutes while a few of the soldiers crawled toward each other and conferred. Then a command was barked, and all but two of the Russians stood and slung their rifles.
Can we move now? Zhang asked.
No, we are still in danger.
Two Russians walked across the plaza toward them. Some meters distant, they stopped.
Do you speak Russian? One asked in Russian.
I do, Zhang replied in kind. My English is better.
My terrible English, the spokesman said, demonstrating his point. You are Chinese?
Yes, we were on a walk, Zhang said.
From this point on, they spoke Russian.
I am Corporal Rozhensky, and this is Corporal Fremov. Something has gone wrong in the library. We are not sure what. We cannot allow anyone to pass. Besides, the building is closed and will not open for us.
Do you have any idea what the trouble is? Zhang asked, struggling to appear especially interested and polite.
No, we heard gunfire, and then the black wall closed and would not open.
Why was there gunfire?
We do not know, Rozhensky said, glancing nervously at Fremov. We have communicated with our superiors in the fourth chamber, but they have not arrived yet.
We will help any way we can, Zhang said, or if you wish, we will leave.
No, perhaps you can approach the door, try to make it open. It may be ridiculous, but then again,
Rozhensky shrugged. Then suddenly realized guns were still being trained on the pair.
Do you have weapons? He asked, looking over his shoulder at the prone rifleman.
No, we are scientists.
Rozhensky called out for the riflemen to put away their guns.
We are not familiar with this place, he said. It makes us nervous, especially now. Our officers are inside that building, searching for a fugitive.
He frowned and seemed to realize he was revealing too much to outsiders.
Please come with us and see if the door will open for you.
Zhang explained what had happened to Wu, who maintained a look of intense interest as they were escorted to the library entrance. The soldiers milled around in some confusion. Wu approached the black wall, hands held up, and touched the smooth surface with his fingers and palms. It did not dilate, as he had been told to expect. He stepped back and lowered his hands. "Sorry," he said. "It doesn't seem..." A low vibrating series of tones issued from the wall and repeated, followed by a voice. "Police attention required in this precinct," the voice said in Russian. "No entrance to unauthorized personnel. Please alert medical and police authorities immediately. No entrance allowed." It then repeated its message in English and Chinese. The soldiers backed away, AKVs unslung and pistols drawn.
"Something must have happened inside," Zhang said calmly to Rozhensky.
"Perhaps we should tell our own superiors. Wouldn't that be wise?" She looked up at the Russian with her narrow almond eyes, her face a mask of persuasion and equanimity. Wu felt tremendous admiration for her. He had never seen her react to this sort of crisis. Corporal Rozhensky thought that over, shook his head firmly, then slumped his tension-hunched shoulders and seemed to reconsider. "What do we do if it doesn't open?" he asked.
"It doesn't open now."
"Our leaders are inside. All of them," he said. Zhang maintained her intent gaze. "Yes, all right," Rozhensky finally said. "Please go and bring your own superiors."
"Thank you," Zhang said.
She took Wu by the arm and walked with him back across the plaza.
"Very strange," she exclaimed, shaking her head in wonder. "Most strange."
"You were wonderful," Wu said, awestruck.
"Thank you,"
she smiled appreciatively. Chapter 46. He had buried his parachute and now lay down in the long, sweet-smelling, dry yellow grass near the road. Hands over his eyes, he waited for a truck or car to come along so he might hitch a ride back to Podlitki. Or was it that base in Mongolia with only a number, 83? Not that it mattered. The sun was warm, and except for a slight headache, Major Mirsky felt grand. He had fallen so far off course that he might take hours to reach the base, missing dinner, but also missing the political instruction. He would gladly trade Kasha for a few hours alone to think. At length, a dusty, long black Volga came down the road and stopped beside him. The rear window rolled down, and a bulky, beefy-faced man in a gray fedora stuck his head out, frowning at Mirsky. "What are you doing here?" the man asked. He resembled Major General Sosnitsky, but he also looked a bit like poor Zhadov, who had died in the borehole massacre, wherever that was and whenever. "What's your mother's name?"
"Nadia," he said. "I need a ride."
"And what did you have for a cake on your 11th birthday?"
"Comrade, I don't see..."
"It's very important. What did you have?"
"Something with chocolate, I think."
The man in the fedora nodded and opened the door. "Get in," he said. Mirsky squeezed in beside him. The seat was wet with blood. The man's three companions were corpses, all alike, all with their heads bloody and brains leaking. "Do you know these people?"
"No, I don't," Mirsky said, laughing. "We haven't been introduced."
"They are you, comrade," the man said, and the dream faded to grayness. Once again he buried the parachute. He began to get suspicious. Finally, after he had been picked up for the seventh or eighth time, the car minus its corpses, and the man in the fedora asked him about his Komsomol days, Mirsky decided to ask some questions of his own.
"I know I'm not dreaming, comrade. So where am I?"
"You have been very badly injured."
"I don't seem to remember that."
"No, but you will. You were shot in the head and suffered severe trauma. Parts of your brain are missing. You will never remember your life in quite as much detail, and you will never be quite the same person again."
"But I feel whole."
"Yes," the man in the fedora agreed. "That is normal, but it's an illusion. Together we've been exploring, finding out what you have left. There is quite a lot, actually. Surprising, considering the damage. But you will never be quite the..."
"Yes, yes," Mirsky interrupted. "So, will I die?"
"No, you are out of danger. Your head and brain are being repaired, and you will live. But you have decisions to make."
"What sort of decisions?" You can live with the missing portions left blank, or you can receive prosthetic neurological programming and artificial personality segments tailored to fit those remaining to you.
Now I'm really confused.
The man pulled a picture book out of his satchel. When he opened it, the pages were filled with beautiful, complex designs, some in garish color, others muted and metallic, still others stimulating tastes and bodily sensations. He took the book and read through it. When he was finished, he asked, "Will I know what is mine and what is not?" "If that's what you want." "And without all these prostheses, what will I be?" "A cripple." "You will have memories," the man explained, "though some will be difficult to recall clearly, and others will have curious gaps. It will take you weeks to learn how to see again, and you will never see very well. You will never recover your sensations of smell or the sensation of touch on the left side of your body. Your mathematical reasoning abilities will be intact, but your speech will be impaired and may never return." Mirsky looked at the man's face until it seemed to fade into the sky beyond the car's side window. "It doesn't sound like much fun," he said. "It is your choice." "You're in the library, aren't you?" "Not what you're seeing," the man said. "I am a city function shaped to be acceptable to you in your present condition. Human medical authority is not available, so the city has taken it upon itself to repair you."
"Okay," Mirsky said. "That's enough for now. I want to have nothing but darkness."
"Yes, that will come naturally after you give us your answer."
"I mean, I wish to die."
"That is not an option."
"Okay, then, yes."
He made the decision quickly, so as not to have to consider all the possibilities, all the horrors. "You consent to prosthetic programming?"
"I consent."
The man ordered the car to stop and smiled. "You may get out," he said.
"Thank you."
"You're welcome." Mirsky left the Volga and closed the door. "Oh, one more thing," the man said, leaning out the window. "Did you have any plans to harm either Bilizersky, Vilgorsky, or Yazykov? Particularly Vilgorsky?"
"No," Mirsky said. "They irritated me, and I would have rather done without all of them, except maybe Vilgorsky. But no, I didn't plan to harm them."
"Thank you," the man said, and rolled up the window.
"You're welcome again."
Mirsky turned away from the road, and it was night. He lay down in the grass and stared up at the blackness. Chapter 47. "I'd like it dark, please," Lanier said. The rooms darkened. He sat upright on the illusory couch and mentally repeated what Patricia had said after the meeting. Alarms set off. Did she mean that the Axis City had known they were in the stone since their arrival? How long had self-contained, self-powered Olmi been watching them? As he mulled, he felt the ineffable tension in the lower part of his abdomen and realized that mentally he was as uninterested in sex as he could be, but his body was disregarding his brain. The door voice announced, "Karen Farley is in the hallway and requests entrance." "Why?" he asked abruptly, angry at the convenience, the coincidence. "Wait. Is she alone?"
"Yes."
"Send." "Let her in." He stood and smoothed down the jumpsuit he had worn on the V-stole, now cleaned and pressed. He had ignored the robe laid out for him on the elliptical bed in the single bedroom. Karen had not. As the door irised open, the lights came up and she entered in a very similar robe, this one a golden beige rather than midnight blue.
"Pardon my comeuppance," she said, smiling and lifting her hands as if to fend off a rebuff.
"What?
Is that the right phrase?"
"I don't think so," Lanier said. "What can I do for you?"
"I've been talking with Patricia," she said. "Or rather, she came to me, and I thought you'd like to know a few things."
He indicated a chair opposite the couch. "She and I had a conversation before the meeting, but it was more confusing than informative."
"Heinemann and Carolson are together tonight," Farley said, sitting. "Patricia didn't tell me that. Lenore did. And before we left the stone, I noticed Wu and Zhang were sneaking away together."
She smiled at him,
a brisk armored smile with a touch of puzzlement and irritation. Lanier lifted his shoulders and clapped his hands together softly, then rubbed them. "That's normal," he said.
"Yes, but I caught you when your guard was down, didn't I? I mean..."
"I appreciate what you did."
"I don't know what to say."
She looked around the apartment curiously.
"I've never really had a leech for you."
"Lech," he said, grinning.
"Oh, yes, my God. Lech. I haven't, but you looked so lost, and I was feeling lost, too. Honest, you're still the boss."
"That's not important," he said.
"What did Patricia..." "It is important," Farley said flatly. "I enjoyed you. I believe you enjoyed me. It was healthy, too. I just wanted you to know I thought so, and don't resent you."
Lanier said nothing for a moment, regarding her with his dark, falsely Amerindian eyes. "I wish I spoke Chinese so we could really understand each other. I could learn..."
"That would be useful, but not necessary right away," Farley said.
She smiled.
"I could teach you."
"What did Patricia say?"
"She thinks we're being used by somebody, Olmi or somebody else, to some end. Olmi has been talking to her a lot, and she's even had some conversations with the Frant. She thinks there's a lot of politics in the Axis City, and we can't possibly know what any of it means, not yet. Also, she says the data service in her apartment actually accesses less information than the ones in the Third Chamber City. She thinks they may be censored for us."
"That doesn't sound good," Lanier mused. "Or rather, it might not be good. It might not mean anything. They might want to treat us gently, let us get accustomed slowly."
"I told her I thought that, and she just smiled. She's behaving strangely, Gary. She also said she has a way to get us all home. There was a real tinkle in her eye when she said that."
Lanier did not correct her. "She told me that, too. Did she elaborate?"
"Pardon? Oh, yes, she did. She said the corridor moves forward in time about 1 year every 1,000 kilometers, and she said it's the most beautiful curve she's ever conceived. Gary, they kidnapped her. She believes this. They kidnapped her because they were afraid we might interfere in the Sixth Chamber. Remember all the people, all those Naderites in the Second Chamber being forced to move out, years after the Third Chamber exodus?"
He nodded.
"Patricia says she thinks they were forced out against their will because the people on the Axis City wanted the stone empty. No interference, no sabotage. That's why she thinks we are stuck in the middle of politics. There is still division between Naderites and Geshels."
"Has it occurred to anybody that no matter what we're told, these rooms are bugged?" Lanier asked. "That perhaps we shouldn't be discussing these things here?"
"Where can we discuss them?" she asked innocently.
"They could follow us anywhere they wanted and listen to us, maybe even read our minds. We have children here, very ill-educated children." Lanier looked down at the milky translucent table between the couch and the chair. "That makes sense. I really like the way this apartment is decorated."
"Mine's nice, too."
"And how would they..."
"The rooms, I presume. Know what we like."
Her expression became conspiratorial.
"Right," she said. "I've asked the room voice, and it just says, the rooms are made to suit."
Lanier leaned forward on the couch. "This whole place is incredible. Unbelievable. Are we dreaming, Karen?" She shook her head solemnly. "All right, then. Is Patricia dreaming she's found a way out? A way to go back to Earth?"
"Oh, she doesn't want to go back to Earth the way it is now. She says she can take us home, whatever she means. And she's serious. She'll explain later," she said.
"You're a physicist. Is what she says possible?"
"I'm just another child here, Gary. I don't know."
"What else did she say?"
"That's it. And..."
She stood.
"I'll go now, but I didn't just..." "Oh."
She clasped her arms around herself and looked at him.
"Not just to tell you what she said. To make sure you understood I wasn't taking advantage."
"I understand."
"It's just, like you say, healthy, though I've been worrying.
He hadn't called it healthy. She had, but he found the transference acceptable.
Don't.
Okay, Farley said.
He stood.
In fact, his face flushed again. I feel just like a teenager when you're here and we talk like this.
I'm sorry, she said, her face falling.
No, that's good. Until now I felt like a very old man, losing all my marbles. I would enjoy it if you stayed with me tonight.
She smiled, then abruptly frowned. I will enjoy that, and I will stay, she said. But it worries me about Patricia.
Yes?
She is now the only one of us sleeping alone.
Chapter 48. Step by step, Patricia traced the progress of the curve through five dimensions, watching it unfold like some nightmare staircase, one part shadowing, one part a necessary negative of the primary curve. Her eyes were closed so tightly they hurt, and her face was convulsed into an expression between ecstasy and grief. She had never known an intensity of thought like this, so deep an involvement in her inner calculations. It frightened her. Even when she opened her eyes to the twilight blueness of the ceiling and rolled over on her side, one hand reaching into the emptiness beyond the bed. Even then, her finger traced a part of the curve, a projected and living snake in the air. Clenching her fist, she saw little spots of light gather along the path her finger had made. She closed her eyes again, and immediately slept, dreaming the curve. She was still half aware in her sleep, and she watched from a distant vantage point as her brain continued, though at a reduced level, the work she could not put a stop to. Only a few hours later, she came instantly awake, realizing she needed to re-examine her seminal article, the one she had yet to write, which she had found in the Third Chamber Library. With some apprehension, the data service, in the four times she had resorted to it, had not always provided what she needed. She got out of the oval bed and donned her lavender robe, tying the belt as she walked through the dimly lit living room. "Data, city memory," she said. An armillary sphere appeared before her, its bands glowing red and gold. Two circlets, one above the other and twice the diameter, followed, a replacement for the antiquated question mark.
"Access to article by Patricia Luisa Vasquez." "Oh, Lord, I've forgotten the exact title and date. Do you need them?"
Complicated ticks flashed until she deactivated them and requested spoken language only. "Do you wish to see a complete list of the short works of Patricia Luisa Vasquez?" the data service voice asked.
"Yes," she said, again touched by the prickling spookiness of what she was doing.
Roman alphabet listings appeared before her as if on an extensive sheet of white paper. About midway through the list appeared, "Theory of N-spatial geodesics is applied to Newtonian physics with a special discourse on rho-simplon world lines."
"That's it," she said. "Display."
She reread the paper carefully and drummed the fingers of her free hand on the edge of the seat.
"It's brilliant," she said grimly, "and it's wrong. It might have been an influential paper, but it was obvious to her now that it was an early and primitive work. Please display the list again."
The service obliged, and she picked out a later piece and requested that it be displayed. The old and familiar symbol of the spiked ball appeared. "Interdicted," the voice said. She chose another, feeling her anger rise. "Interdicted." And another toward the end of the list, written when she was, would be, about 68. "Interdicted."
"Why are my papers interdicted?" she asked angrily.
The spiked ball was the only reply.
"Why is this service being censored?"
She suddenly experienced the neck-itching realization she was no longer alone in the room.
"Olmi? Lights up!"
The room brightened. No answer. She stood up and looked around slowly, her whole back tensing. Then she saw the intruder, hovering near the ceiling, a gray baseball-sized roundness with a face in the middle. For a moment, she did nothing but return the face's scrutiny. It seemed masculine, with small dark Asiatic eyes and a pug nose. Its expression was hardly menacing. If anything, it was intensely curious. She backed up against the wall. The face did not move, but its eyes followed her closely. "Who are you?" she asked. Symbols appeared around the room, incomprehensible to her. "I don't pit," she said. "Please, what are you doing here?"
"True, I'm not supposed to be here," the face said. It fell a couple of feet, the ball assuming the color of a rosy dawn. "But then I'm just an icon myself. Please don't be alarmed."
"I am alarmed. You're scaring me. Who are you?"
"I'm from City Memory. A rogue."
"I don't know you," she said. "Please go away."
"I can't possibly harm you. Irritate you, perhaps. I only need a few questions answered."
The globe dropped and fleshed out like a vampire in an old horror movie to form a masculine body, clothed in loose white shirt and forest green pants. The figure seemed to solidify. In her room now stood a small, delicate man, appearing slightly younger than middle age, with long black hair and a weary, thin face. Patricia's heart slowed, and she moved a few inches out from the wall.
"I pride myself in my accomplishments," the image said. "I have access to the very best records. Forgotten records, actually. There's such an awful clutter in the lower levels of City Memory. And what I've found is the partially purged record of a court case. Something serious, actually. Violation of flaw security. Bits and pieces of information pointed here. Subtle connections, I admit, but intriguing."
The figure seemed familiar, as if she had met him or seen him somewhere else. "What are you doing here?"
"I'm a rogue. A rather violent one, actually, though you wouldn't know it to look at me. I go where I please, and so long as I'm careful, I maintain. I've been non-corporeal for 150 years now, supposedly condemned to inactive memory. Of course, there's only a copy of me inactivated. Sometimes I'm hired for various jobs. Usually I duel with other rogues. I've taken down 60 in my time. Lethal chess."
"You haven't answered my question." She was close to tears now. She couldn't think who the rogue reminded her of. "Leave me alone. I just want to think."
"Rogues are never very polite. You're attracting a lot of attention in Axis, Nader. I hadn't any idea where you were, though, until you used the data service just now. A tracer found you. One of my very best tracers, based on the patterns of a mouse."
"Please," Patricia shouted to the apartment. "Get him out of here."
"It's no use," the rogue said. "Where are you from?"
Patricia didn't answer. She edged toward the bedroom door.
"I've been commissioned to find out where you're from. I've been paid in advantages over a very long-term adversary. I will not leave until you tell me."
"Who hired you?" she shouted, really frightened now.
"Let's see. I'm speaking 20th century English. American, actually. That's very surprising. Only the most die-hard Amerophiles actually learn to speak the language as well as you do. But why would anybody be interested in an Amerophile?"
The image followed her into the bedroom.
"They aren't paying me for guesswork. Tell me."
Patricia ran to the main door and ordered it to open. It did not. She gulped a breath of air and turned to face the image, suddenly determined not to lose control.
What do I get in return, she asked, if I tell you?
Maybe we can trade.
Let me sit down, then.
Oh, I wouldn't stop you from doing that. I'm not cruel, you know.
You're a ghost, she said decisively.
More so than most ghosts you meet, the image elaborated.
What's your name?
I don't have one now. Spoor, but no name. Yours?
Patricia.
Not a common name.
Suddenly, she retrieved the memory of the rogue's face. Just as suddenly, she rejected the clue. It was ridiculous.
I'm really an American, she said.
What percentage? Most are happy to claim 3 or 4%, though statistically that has to be a pose.
100%.
I was born in the United States of America, in California. Santa Barbara.
The image wobbled again. Not much time, Patricia Luisa Vasquez. What you say doesn't make any sense by itself, but you seem to believe it. How did you grow up so uncluttered in primary?
Where I come from, and when...
She took another deep breath to calm herself. That's almost all the choice there is.
She cocked her head to one side.
I know you, she said.
You look like Edgar Allan Poe. The rogue betrayed some surprise. Fancy you recognizing that. Fancy that indeed. Did you know Poe?
Of course not, Patricia said, feeling an incongruous tingle of delight beneath her fear.
I read him. He's dead.
He's my chosen mentor. Such a mind. The rogue surrounded itself with rapid pics of sepulchral figures, live burials, ships in whirlpools, and arctic wastes. Patricia Luisa Vasquez recognizes Poe, claims to be a 21st century American.
Fascinating.
I have to go soon. Ask me what you need to know, and then I'll ask you one more thing.
What are they going to do with us?
Us? There are others?
Four others. What are they going to do?
I really don't know. I'll try to find out. Now, my last question for this visit. Why are you so special to them?
Because of what I just said.
To her surprise, all her fear was gone. The rogue, or ghost, or whatever it was, seemed to be willing to cooperate, and she saw no reason to be foolishly loyal to their kidnappers. We can help each other, I think. Did you know your data service has a block on it? They're keeping you here, and they're selectively cutting off your access. If you tell them I've been here, I may not be able to come back, and I won't be able to answer your question. Think about it. Until next time, the rogue said, and vanished. The apartment suddenly found its voice. Ser Vasquez, are you well? There has been interference.
Don't I know it, Patricia said.
Could you describe the difficulty?
She bit on her knuckle for a moment, then shook her head. No, she said, it wasn't much of a problem.
The image had frightened her, but it had told her a number of interesting things, too. She doubted the incident was a test or experiment. The rogue might prove a useful source of information.
Must have been a short circuit or something, in your works, you know.
The room did not respond for some seconds. Repairs will be made if necessary. Do you need anything?
No.
No, thank you, Patricia said. She looked at the picture, frowning, and again bit at her knuckle. Chapter 49. The presiding minister of the Infinite Hexamon Nexus, Ilyan Tor Engel, kept his quarters in one of Central City's six broad ventilation shafts, buried deep in the spreading wall. Olney had never wished to settle into a primary home, but he envied the PM his quarters nonetheless. There was such an air of isolation and peace in the Wald, and such a fantasy of elegance in the quarters themselves. The six shafts ran straight from the outermost facets of Central City to the governing spheres of the precinct's core. Within each shaft, as many as 10,000 corporeals lived among the winding paths through the Wald. Their homes varied from thick clusters of communal glass floats anchored to the broad aerial routes, to small free-moving cells adequate for one or at most two homorphs, or no more than four of the average neomorphs. The Wald was both decoration and a nod to Naderite philosophies. About a third of Central City's atmosphere needs were taken care of in the shafts, with Geshel-designed scrubbers doing the rest. Thousands of varieties of trees and other plants, some food-bearing, had been genetically altered and adapted to weightlessness. Fully a third of the Axis City's biomass was botanical and concentrated in the Wald. One of Olmi's great pleasures was to Tarzan through the Wald, flying from root to limb, drifting down the paths without benefit of traction fields. There were designated sport paths and quickways with many exercising homorphs and a few whizzing neomorphs, and virtually no vehicles. He had timed himself on 1,000 different occasions on the more difficult of these, and had honed his time down to as little as 15 minutes from outer facet to shaft bottom. Now, however, he felt no need to race. He Tarzaned at a leisurely pace, arms folded behind his back, legs cocked like a skater's, kicking from broad leaf to smooth-worn root surface, following well-traveled courses down the path. More valuable than speed was the time to think. Plastic tubes containing thick luminescent soups of bacteria, known as light snakes or glowworms, wound through the Wald, each a meter thick and sometimes half a kilometer long. In glades, they would macrame across one side in dazzling bright patterns, proximity making some glow peach and red, others dull down to a rich dark gold. Homorphs often gathered in the glades to bathe in the light from the patterns. Only barely glanced into the few glades he passed, intent on his steady progress down the shaft. It took him 20 minutes to reach the presiding minister's quarters. He left the main path by way of a narrow fork and drifted through the flowering hoops formed by a tormented root. The quarters floated in the middle of the PM's private glen. The residence was designed like an old 18th-century terrestrial English manor house, with many modifications to allow for the lack of up and down. There were three roofs and ways to enter the house from 6 different angles. Bay windows opened on 3 axes. Geometric cypress growths screened one window against a glowworm pattern at the far end of the glen. Monitors flew up to him as soon as he emerged from the flowering hoop tunnels and identified him positively, retreating to their other duties, hedge trimming, insect watch, and keeping track of the PM's pets. The house voice welcomed him and requested he enter by the bright door, facing the glowworm pattern. The PM would be with him directly. Olmi braced himself into a dormer and watched with a mix of condescension and boredom a brief picting of the household's recent activities. When the picture cleared, he saw an unfamiliar neomorph preceding the PM into the waiting room. The neomorph, vaguely fish-shaped, limbless, regarded Olmi with a crystalline fox face and picted casual greetings but no ID. Olmi returned the greetings with a similar deletion, recognizing one of Toller's aides. The neomorph exited through the bright door, surrounded by its own midge cloud of compact monitors. "Getting more and more daring, aren't they?" the PM asked, extending his hand. Olmi shook it. "Now I ask you, would you trust somebody you can't shake hands with?" "I've not trusted many I could shake hands with," Olmi said. The PM regarded him with a mixed expression of humor and not quite hidden irritation. "You've come to brief me on our newest ancestral guests." He ushered Olmi into his broad duodecahedral internal office. The PM's round desk gimbaled on the single rod at the center. 7 of the walls were covered by rootwood cases containing antique books and message blocks. Other walls held fine illusory art and false windows, opening onto time-delayed scenes of other rooms in the house, edited to take out whatever occupants were in them. "The president is still upset," Ingle said, tucking his elbows in to sit behind the desk. "I'm afraid most of the president's council are finding it difficult to understand why you brought the 5 back with you."
"I only brought 1, Olmi corrected. "The others followed on their own, unexpectedly."
"Yes. Well, however they got here, they're trouble. Secessionists are seeking advantages already, and concessions. They're not far from getting all their groups together, and this certainly could unite them. It could also convert the Kozhinovsky faction from a radical party to a popular front. The president's position could be endangered. Even so, he feels he doesn't have the time to oversee these difficulties directly, what with the Jart conferences still filling his days, so he's assigned Sir Ollaghan Toller, whom you've met, I believe, and myself."
"Bearers of bad news are never appreciated," Olmi said.
"Yes? Well, whether the news itself is actually good or bad depends on how we react, does it not? Frankly, I don't share all the president's misgivings. Some, but not all. I feel we can turn the situation, and the news, to our advantage. Perhaps we can even achieve the consensus we need to face the Jarts effectively. Now, your message said you had more news."
"Someone has hired at least 1 rogue in city memory to penetrate the guest quarters. Someone is desperate to find out what all the fuss is."
"Yes, that much I could have guessed," the PM said. "Well then, perhaps it's time we released all we know. It's probably going to be common knowledge in a week or less, especially if rogues are in on it. What's your opinion, Sir Olmi?"
"I voiced it before, sir. I should testify before the Nexus."
The PM considered that for a moment. "I still have my doubts as to the wisdom of that. But you may be right. If the truth must be unveiled, let us do the unveiling, no? But delicately. Millions of neomorphs are already scared silly by the secession talk. Drop a bombshell into the middle of it, saying the Thistledown has returned to Earth. Not an easy decision. At any rate, we can't call a full Nexus because of the Jart conferences. A partial will have to do." He left the desk, betraying his nerves. "I'll need a heavy session of Talsa this evening. He crossed his arms and floated in the middle of the office, his voluminous black robes assuming billows of repose.
You will testify in person, then, as an agent of the Hexamon?
The Frant and I, Olmi confirmed.
The Frant won't testify. It's against their creed to take an oath.
It will confirm my testimony. That's allowed.
And what then, Ser Olmi? How can we restrain our curious ones, whoever hired the rogue, or the Korzhanovsky faction? Numa, be kind after that.
That may not be our greatest problem. There are still 2,000 humans in the Thistledown. Sooner or later, we have to bring them under our control. Our first guest, Vasquez, was already very close to learning how to manipulate the sixth chamber machinery. I assume others will eventually duplicate her work, despite the interdictions in the Thistledown libraries.
Star Fate and Numa never see fit to limit our troubles, do they? The PM said with a sigh that upset the billows of his robe. Logos be praised.
Logos, Olmi echoed doubtfully.
We share a certain Geshel incredulity, don't we? The PM said, watching Olmi's reaction carefully. Not wise to reveal it to everyone, however. Not from this lofty position, anyway. Is there immediate danger of our ancestors? Such a word. Is there much chance of their disturbing the sixth chamber soon?
Not with Vasquez in the Axis City. Not in a matter of months or even a year.
Very well. First things first. I'd say it would be in our best interests, if we reveal it all, and that seems unavoidable now, to make a public show of our guests. They are extraordinary, and they might give us an advantage over the president's opposition. I'll have my secretaries plan an agitprop. Their advocate, your partner, Suliram Kikura, has she been useful?
Very, Olmi said, but her work has hardly begun.
Excellent, the PM said, but we mustn't be too confident. If the Jarts start their offensive early, or heaven forbid decide to open a gate into a star's heart, then our visitors will mean next to nothing.
Ingo shook his head, picking a chain of symbols, a gnat being consumed in a solar prominence.
Chapter 50 Corporal Rodzinski lay with his back against the black library wall. Before him were scattered ration packets and tins, some Russian, most American. He snored lightly and regularly. Beside him, Major Garavedian had squatted to eat an American dinner of ham and potatoes au gratin, imported from the fourth chamber as part of the as-yet-unratified treaty agreements. As he ate, he kept a wary eye on the American soldiers lounging several dozen meters across the quadrangle. The forces were exactly equal, 10 Russians, 10 Americans, all armed with rifles but without lasers. There would be no silent assassinations. Tensions had calmed shortly after the Americans had arrived at the behest of Corporal Rodzinski and the Chinese man and woman. The library had been sealed ever since, with Lieutenant General Mirsky, Colonel Vyagorsky, Majors Bilizersky and Yazykov, and Lieutenant Colonel Pogodin held incommunicado. There had been some suspicion at first that American trickery was involved. Garabedian had decided otherwise after several hours of talks with Prityikin, Sinoviev, and the American civilian leader, Hoffman. No one knew what had happened within the library, although Hoffman had expressed an all-too-plausible theory that made no one happy. Garabedian still mulled the theory over, shifting his eyes between the implacable black wall and the American soldiers. The Zampolites, Hoffman suggested, had tried to kill General Mirsky. Whether or not they succeeded, the library building had sealed itself off to prevent further violence and perhaps preserve evidence. All they could do was wait. It had been a week. During that time, Garabedian and Pletnyov had managed to keep the Russian troops from doing anything unwise, factionalizing, spreading agitation, or unfounded speculation. Work had proceeded on construction of their quarters in the fourth chamber. A few Russians, 52 at last count, had simply left the camps and vanished into the fourth chamber woods. 5 had been found so far, well fed. The woods were full of various edible plants. But 3 of those 5 had been fetal-curled and withdrawn in delayed shock. American psychologists had offered to help. There had been similar cases among the Americans, most notably Joseph Rimskaya, who had been stricken just 3 days before. He had wandered into the main Russian camp in the fourth chamber, weeping uncontrollably. his clothes and back in shreds from self-flagellation. He had been returned to the Americans, but Garabedian did not think it wise to allow Russian soldiers access to American psychologists. What he felt above all was sadness, a sense of loss which almost overwhelmed his sense of duty. He, like Nirsky and most of the young officers, had been part of the new Russian military experiment, begun to fix the problems highlighted by the manifold failures of the Little Death. They and their colleagues had worked with each other as a team, not as brutal antagonists in a throwback 19th-century system. They had achieved great things, increasing efficiency and decreasing alcoholism, desertion, violence, and suicide. They had been the new breed, and their successes had made them cultural heroes. The conquest of the potato would have brought them untold glory. Instead, through some error he could not yet comprehend, they had failed miserably, and their heritage was now ashes. Garabedian understood all too well the pressures which drove his comrades to swim to the Fourth Chamber Islands and lie down on the forest floor, pulling humus and mold over their soaking fatigues. The director of the Infinite Hexamon Nexus, Hulain Ram Sager, could trace his ancestry back to the greater East Asian Geshels, who had first returned man to space 13 centuries before. Yet he looked less human than the Frant. In this, he was typical of many neomorph citizens occupying Central City. Ram Sager was round, one half of his body brushed silvery metal, the other half an elegant black and green swirled mineral shell from the worlds accessible through the 264 gate. His face, which could be projected to any of three different positions on the sphere, had large inquiring eyes and a sharp-toothed grin, which was definitely not designed to mask his basic aggressiveness. His two muscular arms had the twin advantages of human appearance and prosthetic adaptability. They could stretch 2 meters if need be. He had no legs, using his arms and the ubiquitous traction fields to get from place to place. He was less than a century old, and this was his second shape. For his first 30 years, he had been as homorphic as any orthodox Naderite. It was in those years that Ram Sager had made his contacts and learned the basic political skills. To Olmi, he exemplified the quintessential Journey Century 12 radical Geshel. Ram Sager was number 4 in the power hierarchy of the Hexamon, behind the president, the presiding minister of the Nexus, and the minister of the Joint Axis Council. In the Nexus sphere, located just outside the flaw passage near the core of Central City, Ram Sager had convened 23 corporeal representatives and 5 senators in a discovery session. 20 of the Nexus members were present incarnate, which was a word that had lost much of its meaning centuries before. Now it meant little more than being in primary physical form. Such form did not necessarily include much flesh. By law, no partial personalities were allowed in the chambers, however convenient that would have been for those still confined to the Jarts Conference, being held on Timbal, the Frant home world. Ram Sager guided himself to the middle of the sphere and took on the golden armillary bands of light to announce the meeting's start. Olmi drifted at the outside, the Frant curled up beside him, only neck and head extended. Olmi had ended an exchange with Corp. Rep. Rosen Gardner some minutes before on an apparently disputatious note. The new Orthodox Naderite leader of the Korzhanovsky faction had wanted a little preliminary testimony, and Olmi had resisted. Gardner was one of the few Corp. Reps who broke procedure often and was tolerated nonetheless. He was also one of the few Korzhanovsky factioners who was reasonable in a debate. In the eyes of the radical Geshels, this, and his large following of Naderites, made him a particularly dangerous opponent. In the name of Star, Fate, Numa, and the Good Man, who sought equality and fair deals for all consumers, and who sought the end of overwhelming and inhuman technology, this meeting of the Infinite Hexamon Nexus convenes. "There is news, gentle people," Ram Sager announced. "There is news. Our testimony is from Sir Olmi. We also have corroboration from one of our valuable allies who helped Sir Olmi with his investigation." Olmi and the Frant advanced to the center and received their armillary bands. "I have spent the past year in the Thistledown, at the request of the presiding minister," he said. "This Frant accompanied me. Together we investigated an unusual intrusion. Do we have permission to play back our records and to testify by picting?
Ramseja gave his permission.
For each of the senators and corp reps, the seven chambers of the Thistledown were displayed in considerable detail. In a few minutes, they became acquainted with the new human occupants of the Thistledown's chambers. Olmi and the Frant had managed to record some 500 individuals on their instruments. The compounds were shown, along with a few building interiors. Olmi then demonstrated that the various languages spoken by the new occupants derived from pre-death Earth. The point of view of the picted testimony took a dizzying climb up the south polar cap of the first chamber and zoomed down the borehole. The reactivated rotating docks and staging areas were briefly shown, and then the point of view emerged from the borehole. At a distance of some 30,000 kilometers, the crescent Earth dominated the darkness, the sun emerging from behind its limb in the west. The reaction in the Nexus chamber was extraordinary. Homoform corp reps gasped, all registered strong emotions in various ways. Gardner spoke first. "Blessed Konrat," he said. "He found a way to bring us home again."
"Stricken, not testimony," Ramseja decreed abruptly.
"It is truly Earth," Olmi said. "The Thistledown has returned to its construction orbit, automatically and without our knowledge. The creation of the Way did not remove us from all familiar spaces. It is possible that the Thistledown could have completed its intended journey. It did not. Instead, it sought out the sun and altered its course to return home. But we did not escape all effects of the Way's creation. The Thistledown was indeed shifted into a neighboring continuum, but also into the relative past. It entered its current orbit some 3 centuries before its launch." The chamber was silent, stunned by the implications of what Olmi was saying. The picted testimony continued. In less than 4 minutes, it showed the beginning of the death and concluded with the spectacle of Earth covered with a thick gray pall of smoke on the threshold of the long winter. The stillness in the chamber was profound. Olmi quickly pushed on. "I returned to the city with one of the new occupants, a corporeal woman named Patricia Luisa Vasquez. Subsequently, 4 others violated the access floor by riding a vehicle near the city. They have been acquitted and made guests of Axis Nader. All of them, of course, are corporeal and primitive, of primary form and unsupplemented mentality. They are our pre-death ancestors." The armillary bands now glowed around the first senator assigned to speak. She advanced. Olmi recognized Prescient Oyu, daughter of the still-regnal gate-opener, Rai Oyu. Senator Oyu had worked with Suliram Kikura 2 years before to exempt victims of sex retrovirus from the limit of 2 incarnations. She was known to have Naderite sympathies, though her background was moderate Geshel. She was a homorph with elaborations designed to heighten both sexual and leadership traits. "The Thistledown returned to Earth at the precise moment of the death," she asked. "That is in testimony," Ramseja reminded her.
"Not precisely," Olmi said.
"The Thistledown entered the solar system 5.5 years before the death. I have evidence, presented in subtext, that our arrival, in fact, triggered the death. It is possible that without the Thistledown's presence in orbit around the Earth and Moon, the Earth in this continuum would have escaped the death."
Gardner raised his hands in horror.
"This is an abomination," he said. "Blessed Kozhanovsky could never have intended this."
"All credit to the Hexamon Nexus," Prescient Oyu continued, "but a question arises as I look over the précis on the agenda. Why has this news not been broadcast through the entire city? I suggest we make an unequivocal report public and convene an emergency full Nexus convention."
Her bands of light changed to amber and she receded a meter. Ramseja extended both arms and spread his fingers wide to have Nexus attention.
"The news is startling and important, but it also could have adverse social consequences. We wish to release the news in the most constructive fashion."
Corp Rep Enric Smize, a moderate Geshel with past service to the Hexamon in a capacity similar to Olmi's, objected that the Jarts conference certainly held precedence.
The charts showed every sign of preparing to advance beyond 2X9, and even our subject today compared to that is trivial.
Perhaps not, Corp Rep Smize, said Rosengardner. All these questions may yet be tangled.
Did you find evidence of deliberate reprogramming of the Thistledown guidance system? Ramseja asked.
Olmi rotated to face the center.
I did not, Olmi said. But the system erased all instructions immediately after arrival. There is no way of knowing.
Gardner formally requested the armillary bands. Ramseja, with some hesitation, assented.
It is time once more to ask for a search in city memory, he said. There is one who can tell us all we need to know.
The engineer is dead, Ramseja objected vehemently.
We are aware he is inactive, Gardner said with uncharacteristic control. But blessed Korzhanovsky knew of the danger to his patterns when he retired his corpus. We must authorize a search for any parts of his personality not purged by the assassins.
Overruled, Ramseja said.
I request a hearing before the full nexus, Gardner persisted.
Disallowed.
Procedural inquiry, Gardner said coolly. Ramseja's face rose to the top of the mineral half of his sphere, and he glowered at the corp rep. Only in extremis was a procedural inquiry called for. He had played right into the corp rep's hands by going beyond his jurisdiction.
Seconded, Senator Oryu said, turning her elegant eyes to the surprised gardener.
Procedural inquiry, Ramseja assented. He had no choice. But his expression, now in the middle of his sphere, made it clear Corp Rep Gardner's standing in the Nexus would be weakened by any means in his power.
Olmi listened to the discussion without much interest from that point on, and when his release was given, left the sphere with the Frant to return to Axis Nader. He took a rapid lift to the circle and quadrant where the terrestrials were being secluded. Escorting the Frant into the kitchen lounge area, he credited an open meal for his companion.
You are gracious, Ser Olmi, the Frant said, eyes narrowing as it surveyed the feast possibilities. I assume I am to remain here for a time.
We'll introduce you to the others a little later, Olmi said, his thoughts far away.
I am content.
Olmi keyed open the entrance to the secluded sector. The Frant squatted at the arena of shells, which was a traditional Frant dining table, then turned to blink at Olmi.
You did not expect so much trouble, did you? The Frant said.
Olmi smiled at the Frant from the dilated doorway.
You'd be surprised, he said, and entered the sector with a wink.
Chapter 51 The zero elevator to the borehole staging areas was seldom used now. Only two people continued their work in the staging areas, Roberta Pickney and Sylvia Link. Hoffman considered their work important, however, and made it a point to visit them personally at least once a week. The broad spaces and comparatively low ceilings of the staging areas reminded her of a parking garage, a convention center. With her two marine guards, she took a tracked cart to the communications and control center beneath the prime dock and walked alone into the quiet room. Sylvia Link was asleep in a sling. Roberta Pickney greeted Hoffman quietly and showed her the intercepted transmissions from Earth and the Moon.
Lunar settlement seems to be doing well, she said.
There were heavy bags under her eyes. She looked 10 years older than when Hoffman had first met her.
There are still people on Earth, but they're only using low-power transmitters, working off batteries and windmill generators, I guess. I think one or two small cities are still transmitting these low-power signals, areas that may have been protected by orbiting platforms. I send out our own signals every now and then, but nobody's called back yet. It's only a matter of time.
There are people, at least, Hoffman said.
Yeah, at least. But nobody much cares about us, and why should they?
You should get into the fourth chamber for some R&R, Hoffman suggested. You don't look too well.
I feel pretty lousy, too, but this is all I have left. I'll make it as long as there are voices down there. You're not going to shut us down, are you?
No, of course not, Hoffman said. Don't be silly.
My privilege to be paranoid, Pickney said, thrusting her lower jaw forward and pulling it back with an audible grind of molars.
When Heinemann gets back,
I'll go to work with him refurbishing the shuttle. I'd like to get to the moon. I have friends there.
No word on the expedition, Hoffman said. They're late, but that's not much reason to worry.
Yet.
I may get some of Heinemann's fellows working on the shuttle soon. Give us all something new to think about.
What about the missing Russians? Link asked from her swing, blinking at them sleepily.
Still unavailable for comment, Hoffman said. She took Pickney's hand and squeezed it.
You're needed, she said. Both of you. Don't overdo it.
Pickney nodded without much conviction.
All right. Have Janice Polk and Beryl Wallace spell us in a day or so. We'll go get some tube light and see the sights.
Fine, Hoffman said. Now show me where the signals are coming from. Chapter 52. The rogue reappeared before Patricia as she slept and awoke her by tickling her ear. Miss Patricia Luisa Vasquez, late of Earth, the late Earth, he said. I'm here with some answers. She rolled over and rubbed her eyes. The rogue's appearance had changed. He now seemed to wear baggy pants and a cardigan sweater. His hair was styled in a loose shag, and a watchless fob hung from a belt loop, terminating in a hemlined pocket in the sweater. The rogue was in the height of 2005 fashion. She leaned over the bed and examined his shoes. Huaraches and Japanese tabi socks completed his wardrobe.
They're on to me, he said. I had to slip in a different way. I'm using the auxiliary pictor. The primary is locked. And I've reprogrammed the apartment privacy unit to edit us both out of any record while we talk. I found there is a way to get into the city record. Very disappointing. To the Nexus, apparently nothing is sacred. End of Side 8.